The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. Earlier this year, renowned neurologist Oliver Sacks died of cancer. Public radio listeners may know him from his many contributions to Radiolab, but many more will know him by his contributions to science. His detailed case histories on neurological disorders like Tourette syndrome and post-encephalitis, the latter which he tackled in his most famous book, Awakenings. Sacks was celebrated for his narrative style of writing and for putting an empathetic human touch on hard-to-grasp medical subjects. But some say that long, narrative-driven style of scientific inquiry is fading away. Christine Montross is an author, a practicing psychiatrist, and an assistant professor of psychiatry and human behavior at Brown University. In a recent essay for the Chronicle of Higher Education, Christine says case histories are being replaced by, quote, fetishism of data. And she joins us now to explain. Christine, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
So first of all, could you just explain what a case history or a case study is for listeners who may not be familiar with the term?
So case studies or case histories used to be the real cornerstone of medical education. And the most basic description of this would be that they would describe a person and a person's illness or injury, and then the professor or teacher or clinician who was presenting that case history would talk about what were the potential diagnoses, what were the potential courses of treatment, and share actually how the case evolved and went and what happened when we tried to treat the person that's presented. And often the patient presents sort of a typical illness course or course of injury. So, you know, when medical students are first learning about how to recognize a heart attack and distinguish it from, say, indigestion, you know, a case history might be presented and the students have to pay attention to key details to be able to ascertain the diagnosis. But case histories have also been used to describe real outliers, and they're often used for discussion amongst practicing physicians when a case is really difficult or poses diagnostic or treatment challenges as well.
And would that be something maybe like case studies have been written about, say, the Elephant Man?
Absolutely. So major discoveries have often been described in terms of case histories and case studies. So that would be one. You know, there are all kinds of neurologic studies that are described. You know, a famous one where a railroad worker was shot through the head with a piece of metal that he was working on, and the symptoms that emerged then from his brain injury and really taught us about some of the local functions of and workings of the brain.
You know, what's funny is you mentioned that case. I've heard about that case. So it seems to me that, you know, the case history can reach a general public, maybe in a way that, say, a scientific abstract or just a medical journal can't. So why do you think that they're falling out of fashion?
Well, I have two thoughts about that. I think you're absolutely right. I think that we've learned in many, many realms, politics included, right? We care about people and their plights more when there's a story associated with it instead of just a presentation of data. I think a couple of things have happened that have shifted the emphasis that we allow case histories to have. One is, as you mentioned in the intro, you know, Sienna Craig, an anthropologist at Dartmouth, has coined this term fetishism of data. And I do think that as medicine, in a good way, moves toward being evidence-based and really relying on algorithms and checklists to make sure that treatment is standardized and that important key steps aren't missed from a safety standpoint, there is a way in which we come to value these more algorithmic and number-driven approaches to medicine, when in reality, medicine still happens within the human body. Illness still occurs to people. And once we lose sight of the people, sometimes we lose sight of some of the really key elements of what's going on for them medically as well.
I'm speaking with Christine Montross. She's a practicing psychiatrist and assistant professor of psychiatry and human behavior at Brown University. In a recent essay for the Chronicle of Higher Education, Christine says the case history, once a staple of medical research, is falling out of fashion and being replaced by what she calls a fetishism of data. So this is the sort of subject that I think your average listener just isn't aware of, that case studies are fading away. How can you quantify that? I mean, how do you know that they're falling out of fashion?
so we see that in medical education. Medical specialties and students gather for either didactic lectures or also medical grand rounds. So these are our educational gatherings of a certain specialty or a certain medical school or hospital, and the real purpose is to teach. And it used to be that case histories and case narratives were really at the center of those gatherings, and they aren't any longer. Occasionally you'll have them, but much more frequently these are PowerPoint discussions of the trends of outcomes with certain medications or certain interventions, and the human story palpably feels like one that is less and less a part of the discussion.
Wow, that's so funny, given all the discussion that we have about the importance that doctors and physicians, you know, understand and relate to their patients in the same way that we almost talk about, like, police officers need to sort of be on the ground and understand the community and not just see it from a, you know, from a practicing point of view.
Well, and I think that there is a very pragmatic explanation for some of that part as well, and that is that as financial pressures increase within the healthcare systems, physicians have less and less and less time with their patients. And we've all felt this, right? The physical with our primary care doctors that used to last an hour is now maybe 25 or 30 minutes. My father-in-law complained that he went in recently for his physical and remained in his street clothes the whole time. I think that that as psychiatrists, we're reimbursed much more financially to provide a 15-minute medication visit to someone than we are to sit and do psychotherapy with them. So I also think we're missing out on the opportunity to hear our patients' stories directly from them in the course of our treatment with them.
So when do you think it goes too far, and when do we lose sight of that human element?
Well, I think losing sight of the human element means we've gone too far. I think that when we are looking at illness and the experience of illness as a set of numbers and data, we've lost sight of the fact that it happens to us and to our family members and to our friends. And I think we love to believe, both as patients and doctors, that the human body responds in very predictable ways to illness and injury. But we have all seen examples of people who have survived illnesses they never should have survived, and who have not survived wounds that should have been very easy to fix. And so the body does not always conform to the data. And one of the points that I think it's important not to lose sight of is that data really skews toward the mean. It represents an average, it represents an aggregate, and sometimes the most important things to be learned are the times when that doesn't adhere. What do we learn from the person who died from an illness that should never have been fatal? That might not be included in a set of data points because most people survive it, but really the real lesson to be learned for physicians in training and physicians in practice might be what happened in this person whose case did not conform to the data that we have.
Now, you have written a couple of books, so, and they themselves are sort of case studies, collections of case studies. Part of the idea here is to put a personal face on something that often is impersonal in other types of scientific literature. But what are the ethical considerations that need to be taken into account when you're writing about your patients?
There are many, of course, and there are people who say that physicians should not write about their patients under any circumstances. In fact, one of the most scathing statements about Oliver Sacks, who you mentioned at the beginning, was that he was a man who mistook his patients for a literary career, and that was a riff on his famous book, of course, Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat.
Right.
I think there are people that see writing about patients as inherently exploitative. I don't believe that that is true. I do believe it can be done respectfully. Medicine has a tradition of either really de-identifying patients so they're not recognizable, you know, no protected health information is disclosed, people aren't identifiable, or asking consent of their patients and making sure that you have a patient's permission to write about them. My perspective on this has been strengthened and enhanced by the fact that as a psychiatrist who works with hospitalized mentally ill patients, many, many of my patients are not in a position where they are capable of telling their story. And when I say that, I'm thinking about patients who are floridly psychotic, who are significantly disabled. I have intellectually disabled patients who are nonverbal. And I've grown increasingly frustrated by how that degree of voicelessness means that their stories are not represented in these important political and budgetary discussions that we have as a society. So I've come to view it as not just what are the responsibilities and risks inherent in writing about patients, but what are the responsibilities and risks inherent in not writing about these patients who we treat and the struggles that they endure.
Well, Christine, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
I really appreciate it. I enjoyed it.
Christine Montross is a practicing psychiatrist, an assistant professor of psychiatry and human behavior at Brown University. And you can learn about her own books and collections of case studies, body of work, and Falling into the Fire. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. Marcela Gaviria survived a childhood cancer that nearly took her leg and has been dealing with complications related to that illness for the last 3 decades. Throughout that time, she's been seen by the same doctor and surgeon, Dempsey Springfield. Marcela and Dr. Springfield have lost count of just how many surgeries they've been through together, but when they sat down with StoryCorps, they remembered the very first one.
I think you started taking care of me when I was 12.
You were in the hospital to have a bone transplant.
I was pretty scared, I remember. And I think I survived a very sort of traumatic moment because you were so kind. What I remember about you were your bow ties. You just looked like such a southern gentleman, and you'd show up every morning with such a big smile, and you were so warm and gentle, and I wanted to get better for you. I wanted your surgery to work on me.
I really enjoy taking care of patients. That's probably what came across.
Well, I'd hate to count the amount of times you've operated on me, but every scar in my leg, I think, has something to do with you.
Well, I keep moving and you keep following.
Because I don't trust other doctors as much. And it's funny because when I was a kid, I would complain all the time about how I'd never get married.
I remember very distinctly we would have conversations about this.
Yeah, because, you know, I always wondered how difficult it would be for someone to sign up to my life. Well, I got married this year, and I wanted you to have the first dance. And that was just a way of celebrating the fact that a lot of what I'm able to do nowadays is because of your care.
Your wedding's the first wedding of a patient that I've ever gone to. So it's so rewarding to see that all of that, you know, getting up before the sun comes up to get to the hospital pays off. It wasn't squandered.
Well, I have a great surgeon that really cared to get it right. It's a beautiful thing. Thank you for doing all you did.
That was Marcela Gaviria and Dr. Dempsey Springfield for StoryCorps. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby. Over the past decade, crowdfunding platforms like Kickstarter and Indiegogo have been used to raise capital for countless independent video games, hopeful podcasters, debut albums, smart gadgets, webcomics, community-based initiatives, and countless numbers of hot sauce startups. Well, they're also being used to keep people out of prison. In fact, if you search jail on one popular platform, GoFundMe, you'll get over 2,500 results. People who are in debt, who can't afford to pay speeding tickets, child support, or bail, all of them asking strangers to help pitch in. Caroline Gruskin is with the Marshall Project. That's a nonprofit news organization that focuses on the criminal justice system. That's where you'll find her article about the increasing but unreliable use of crowdfunding platforms for legal matters. And Caroline, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Would you be able to give me just an example of, you know, what's a typical campaign on, say, GoFundMe where somebody is looking to help keep out of jail?
There's a guy named Sean, and he had gotten a DUI. Actually, he's a veteran, and he got this DUI on the night of Veterans Day. He was out drinking with friends, and he ended up being the driver home. He got stopped, and he got a DUI, and he was fined something like $1,800. And he'd spent the year trying to work two jobs to raise enough money to pay off this fine, ultimately had this major setback and had no idea how he was going to pay off the fine and avoid going to jail. And so he went online and he managed to raise actually $2,000 from friends and family around the world.
So I guess that's an example of a success story. But do you have a sense of how often these campaigns work out that way?
So I guess it depends. That was really what I found. I spoke to people who had been really lucky. Some had raised money from friends and family whom they never would have expected to donate. Some even raised money from strangers. But in fact, most people I spoke to really didn't have much success at all. In one kind of sad but slightly funny anecdote, I spoke to a woman and noticed that her account had 5 donations that totaled $450. All of them were from Anonymous. And I asked her if she knew who Anonymous was, and she said, well, actually, that was me.
So she was giving to herself to sort of make it appear as though people were pitching in?
Exactly. And that's actually quite a common strategy, both within this world of crowdfunding for criminal justice-related costs, as well as in the more commercial crowdfunding world. It's pretty common to put in your own money or to ask family and friends to donate at the beginning, you know, because that sends the message to other people, oh, this is a credible campaign, this is something maybe worth giving to, maybe she'll actually reach, you know, what she needs, so my contribution will have been valuable. But unfortunately, in this woman's case, she hadn't encouraged anyone else to donate.
Okay, so then why go to these crowdfunding platforms for legal matters? I mean, what are the advantages, or at least the perceived advantages, for these folks?
So I think there's several. I think it helps people reach individuals they couldn't reach otherwise, you know, maybe family and friends who aren't nearby. It also, one woman told me that part of the reason why she set up the platform online was because she'd been asking around for money and people told her that they really didn't have the cash, but that they would be able to, you know, put a little more money on their credit card if they were able to donate that way.
And I guess maybe is there also just this, you know, this sort of hope that it's somehow going to go viral, that you're going to make thousands of dollars to pay off whatever it is that you need to pay off?
There's definitely that hope.
But it doesn't sound like that's the case very often.
It's really quite infrequent. And I think that's the case. I spoke to an expert about crowdfunding. I think that's the case in a large number of crowdfunding ventures, that really they're kind of more just a digital way of passing the hat. You know, so it's not so unlike asking around your community for money when you need to pay for a medical treatment, or, you know, your dog is impounded, or, you know, you need money for your kids' classroom, art supplies. It's actually a pretty similar process to that. It's just happening online.
Okay, so but there are these exceptions, and you mentioned a couple of them in your article, where something does sort of go viral and makes a big splash, and people, strangers, end up pitching in. Do you have any clues about what differentiates those campaigns from these others that are, you know, like you said, fairly local affairs but online?
I think it definitely has something to do with media attention. I mean, the ones I highlighted in the article, so a fundraiser for the family of Michael Brown raised at least over $300,000. One for Bree Newsom, who was the woman who took down the flag in front of the state capitol in South Carolina. She raised over $125,000. You know, so these were really kind of big cases that a lot of people found out about, you know, that were really big in the media and part of a movement.
Yeah.
I think that's really when they tend to go viral, when it's part of something rather than just being, you know, what is frankly a heartbreaking story, but it's your story.
Now, what about the other side of this? Because, I mean, if you can go online and set up a campaign to pay off a ticket or something that you claim you're innocent for, what about people who, you know, may have committed serious crimes? I mean, are these people also on these platforms trying to, you know, say, raise bond for, you know, sexual assault or things like that?
So, yeah, some of them are on there. And there's been a bit of pushback, it seems, from some of the crowdfunding sites themselves. Some of them are a little bit more open to these. You know, they just kind of have the ideology that, you know, they're a venue. You know, they're not really making any statements about the morality or, you know, how you ought to think about these causes. But GoFundMe, for example, they actually have a specific policy around that you're not allowed to fundraise on their site for violent crimes. But interestingly, there's actually been a site that popped up sort of specifically for people trying to raise money for criminal justice-related causes. And I don't think I've done a thorough enough analysis to say that there are more of the more violent crimes on this platform. But there definitely were cases, you know, trying to raise money for someone who says that they're innocent of a sexual assault claim, or some other sort of more violent crimes, like someone pointing a gun in someone's face.
Now, you work for the Marshall Project. What do you think this trend says, if anything, about the criminal justice system? Or is this just sort of a, you know, a tech story, a story of something that's leapt online that didn't exist there beforehand?
I think this is definitely a symptom of this larger story that we're seeing. It's sort of just about how expensive many pieces of the criminal justice system are, you know, that it can be impossibly difficult to make bail, to pay fines, to raise money for legal counsel. You know, and we're seeing the story everywhere, you know, whether in Ferguson, you know, or in small towns and big cities, you know, we're seeing stories about public defenders' offices that are chronically underfunded, stories about how expensive the justice system is for people. And I think this is, frankly, a symptom of that.
Caroline Gruskin is a contributor to the Marshall Project. That's a nonprofit news organization that focuses on the American criminal justice system. Caroline, thanks so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. The 1952 presidential campaign pitted the immensely popular General Dwight D. Eisenhower against the ferociously intellectual and intensely private Adlai Stevenson. It was an election fought on a new battleground, television. This story is part of the series Contenders, portraits of some of the country's most original presidential candidates. It was produced by Radio Diaries.
My name is Newton Minow. In 1952, I worked as assistant legal counsel to Governor Adlai Stevenson.
Stevenson's the only one, and he wears no boss's coat.
My name is Adlai Stevenson, Adlai Stevenson III. I'm the son of Adlai Stevenson II, who ran for president of the United States in 1952.
We were in the midst of the Korean War. President Harry Truman was extremely unpopular. The country's view of the Democratic Party was very, very low. The opponent on the Republican side was General Dwight Eisenhower, who was one of the most beloved, popular persons in the country. He had won the war for the American people. He could have had the nomination of either party.
Yeah, it was shaping up to be a very difficult year for the Democrats.
Until a few months ago, the name of Adlai Stevenson meant little to the people of the United States.
My name is Jean Baker, and I wrote the book The Stevensons, a biography of an American family. Adlai Stevenson had been the governor of Illinois, but he had not been involved in politics for very long.
But he was very well educated. He had gone to Princeton, and he had written and spoken a great deal. And Adlai believed that a political campaign is an educational process. It's an education for the voter, and it's an education for the candidate.
And so Stevenson decides to go throughout the country and create a informative, moving seminar for the voters. Here's what he said. Let's talk sense to the American people.
Governor Adlai Stevenson, who receives an enthusiastic welcome in Baltimore, the governor expresses himself forcefully on the subject of taxes.
I don't like taxes. I doubt if anybody does. I shall do everything I can to reduce them, but I shall make no promises that I know I cannot keep.
He had great faith in the public, great faith in the voters. Adlai believed that you don't just tell them what they want to hear, you tell them the truth.
And I'll bank on the American people. I'll bank on them even in an election year to understand straight talk and the need for a balanced budget in this country.
Adlai Stevenson's strength, which was these brilliant speeches that he gave, during the presidential campaign against Eisenhower, they became a liability.
I for president. You like Ike. I like Ike. Everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Hang out the banner, beat the drum. We'll take Ike to Washington.
The people who did the Eisenhower campaign were Madison Avenue advertising executives. My name's David Schwartz. I'm the chief curator of the Museum of the Moving Image. It was Rawson Reeves who was most famous for Eminem melts in your mouth, not in your hands. He's the one who really knew that you could kind of boil a campaign down to a little soundbite or a jingle. and millions of people saw that ad and decided they liked Ike.
We'll take Ike to Washington.
Vote for Eisenhower.
Adlai Stevenson, he didn't really believe in things like this. Stevenson just didn't even like the idea of commercials at all. He just felt like, you know, you shouldn't try to sell a presidential candidate the same way you would sell cereal or soap. He just thought this is not what politics is about.
For more than 23 centuries, humanity has striven to attain the ideal.
The Stevenson campaign decided early on that they would buy 30-minute blocks of time on TV and he would do speeches, 30-minute speeches.
If each of us lives up to the moral and the ethical obligations of citizenship.
But nobody tuned in to watch them.
Adlai Stevenson goes west. The Democratic candidates tour includes stops and speeches in Wyoming, Utah, Oregon, Washington, and Texas.
He was on a platform campaigning, and a photographer below the platform took a photograph, which included the sole of his shoe, which had a hole in it. And that photograph became a symbol of this man who, you know, really was thinking more about the issues than he was his shoes. And it caught on, and suddenly buttons were sprouting with, you know, in the shape of a shoe with a hole in it.
I'd rather have a man with a hole in his shoe than a hole in everything he says.
The symbol that many people have held is that Stevenson is frugal. Look, here's his candidate, and he even walks around with holes in his shoe. But the real story of that photograph is that Stevenson, moments before he's going to give this speech, he's not doing what politicians usually do. They point in the second row to Betty, who's helped him on the campaign trail, or Harold, who they think is in charge of the local newspaper. But Stevenson does none of that. He's looking down at his text and making corrections.
This is the final night before one of the most vital elections in the history of our country. Tomorrow, you, the voter, will make the final decision.
On the eve of the election, Stevenson intended to make this last speech one of his best.
Looking back, I am not wholly content that I have said or said well everything that was in my heart. Talking sensibly and honestly is not always easy. It means saying things that sometimes people don't like to hear. It means risking votes, and candidates are not supposed to do that.
He's into this brilliant end-of-campaign speech. But they had only paid for 30 minutes, and time ran out.
People who still believe in one another, in spite of all the timid, doubting men.
And what the viewers saw at home was Stevenson still talking, but they cannot hear him.
You know, he probably wasn't paying any attention to the red lights that were going on and off and the hands that were being waved at him. He was concentrating on his message, and he didn't want to cut it short.
Electric signs flash the news, Ike's in, and bedlam breaks out amongst the Republican supporters as they hear of their landslide victory.
The victory for Eisenhower was overwhelming. I think Adlai carried just a few states. He was never bitter about it. Oh, he wanted to win, of course. But I heard him say this more than once. There are worse things that can happen to a person than losing an election.
We're gonna choose the God that we love. He is the God nobody can shove. We'll make the God the president of the
That story was part of the series Contenders, Portraits of America's Most Original Presidential Candidates. The story was produced by Joe Richman and Samara Freemark of Radio Diaries. Coming up, a technology of the past is born again, a history of the mason jar, when word of mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. If you've attended a trendy wedding recently, or maybe been to a bar where the bartenders prefer to be called mixologists, you've probably seen people sipping out of an old-school container, the mason jar. Once the favorite tool of home canners and 4-H fair competitors, the mason jar has recently come to symbolize the conscious consumer, or at least those who would wish to appear conscious. So, how did the mason jar transform from a humble method of preserving food into a trendy glass for all occasions? Well, let's find out. Ariana Kelly is a writer and author. Her article, The Mason Jar Reborn, appeared in The Atlantic. And Ariana, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So, tell me a little bit about the mason jar's origin story. Where did it come from?
Sure. Well, people have been trying to preserve food against the natural processes of decay for a long time, of course, but canning and the mason jar as we know it really arose in the early 1800s during the Napoleonic Wars. And these were wars that were fought for many years by men who were on long deployments. And because of the length of their deployment, they really only had access to food that was smoked, cured, dried. Because of that, after a while, they just didn't have access to the nutrients they had. They started suffering from scurvy and malnutrition. And the French government decided to issue a contest where I think they offered a reward of 10,000 francs, I believe, for the person who could come up with the best process to preserve foods. And it turns out that a man named Nicolas Appert, who's a French cook, had been working on this problem for quite some time. And his proposal was essentially to boil food in jars and then seal these jars and prevent them from coming into contact with air. He actually started with champagne bottles and sort of sealed them with a sort of improbable mixture of cheese and lime.
Mm.
And he won. And then about 30 years later, or 40 years later in 1858, a man by the name of John Landis Mason, who's actually from New Jersey, invented a jar that had a wider neck and a rib neck and a top that could seal tight. So essentially what he did is he refined a process that had been fairly prone to error. And in the early 20th century, it became a really integral part of farming culture, especially in areas like New Hampshire, where I'm from, that had a really short growing season. It became a really important way for people to have relatively fresh fruits and vegetables in the middle of the winter.
And it sounds like since then, the mason jars had a number of dips in popularity and then resurgences, basically whenever food is scarce or people are looking to get back to the land. And you actually sort of, you had some experience with the mason jar growing up with that sort of get back to the land movement in the 60s and 70s, right?
I did, yeah. My parents were both back to the landers. They fled from the New Jersey suburbs, bought some property in rural New Hampshire.
Fled from the-
Very consciously fled. So they bought some land in rural New Hampshire, built their own house, and of course had their own garden. Even though the growing season was really short, the garden produced a surplus. And when it started to produce a surplus, my mother canned what remained.
And so how do we get to today then, where mason jars are once again in vogue? Is this part of our recent fascination with everything old-fashioned, like artisanal ice, bow ties, that sort of thing?
I think it's definitely part of it. I mean, one of the reasons is that local food in general has had a resurgence thanks to writers like Alice Waters and Michael Pollan and Dan Barber, among many others. People are aware of the tremendous amount of resources that goes into making food and also transporting it and the kind of carbon imprint that leaves. And there's been a return to trying to, you know, create more locally grown produce. There's also, you know, a number of ways in which the mason jar has been repurposed. So if you Google the mason jar, you can find mason jar terrariums, speakers, soap holders, what have you. But the other part of this is that mason jars have become sort of synonymous with thrift, preservation, personal labor. And as such, they've become a really potent signifier for people. They, you know, can enjoy a cocktail in a mason jar and sort of borrow some of the cultural aura that the mason jar has. One thing I noticed recently, and The Atlantic did run a follow-up piece about this, is that Jeb Bush is now using the mason jar as part of his campaign. I think he's using it as sort of... some sort of tchotchke that he's distributing to people. So it's pretty funny.
A mason jar with the lowercase Jeb with the exclamation point?
Maybe. I actually haven't looked at how he's using it. I just thought that he is using it, you know, to kind of milk that kind of folksy down home.
Yeah, you'd think this would be Bernie Sanders territory.
I know. Well, I think it's probably a very conscious choice on Jeb Bush's marketing team, right?
Oh, wow. But, it's funny because like so many hipster trends or anything that's trendy, I suppose. You know, I think about a cocktail in a mason jar, and there's part of me that thinks, oh, that's kind of cool. And then there's another part of me that's just kind of grossed out in some way that's hard to describe. So are we seeing a backlash at all to the sort of mason jar repurposing that's going on right now?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's a backlash to any sort of hipster trend you see. So a couple years ago, there was a 7-Eleven marketing strategy that made a mason jar Slurpee containers.
That really defeats the purpose, doesn't it?
It really does, right. And Galka ran a piece on this, and it just inspired, you know, a train of 200 or 300 comments, mostly about who, in fact, uses mason jars and who's entitled to use them. And I think the issue with having, you know, drinking cocktails out of mason jars or your Slurpees or what have you is that it divorces the mason jar from its original context, which is rooted in functionality, in ensuring that in a time of need there will be plenty.
But what will probably happen is at some point it will stop being trendy, but the mason jar will still have that function. It won't go away because, you know, people still do use it for canning.
Yeah, I mean, I think the mason jar is going to outlast whatever hipster trend is making it currently popular and then have a downturn in popularity because, you know, its usefulness is intrinsic. And I think given the current conditions of climate change, the sense that we may not always have as many resources as we'd like or we need is certainly present in our minds, and that those times of need are the times in which a mason jar is really at the peak of its usefulness.
Yeah. So you grew up in New Hampshire. You're in L.A. now, is that right?
I am.
Do you ever have the urge to start canning some fruits and veggies, get back to your Granite State roots?
I absolutely do, but I live in a one-bedroom apartment, and the only land outside of my house is just one strip of dirt.
Well, it sounds like you're going to be drinking wine out of your mason jars for a while.
Right, exactly.
All right, Arianna Kelly, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much for having me.
Arianna Kelly wrote The Mason Jar Reborn for The Atlantic. She's also author of a book about the phone booth. That's part of a book series about the hidden lives of ordinary things. You can find out more about both, including a link to the article, at wordofmouthradio.org.
My life's all backpacks and mason jars, parking lots, beat-up cars. Don't worry about me, I'm fine. Just a different kind of 9-to-5. Still happy I'm alive, so you do yours and I'll just do mine.
Okay, so I just Googled mason jar hacks and found the search results to be a little overwhelming. Before I stopped scrolling, I saw a makeshift light fixture, a spice rack, candles, and a beehive holder. Well, I want you to send in your favorite or most absurd oddball uses for mason jars. Either one will work. Share them on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. And bonus points if your mason jar hack is actually as easy as it looks on the internet.
Well, mama, let me tell you.
The mason jar is an icon of utility. Its simple and transparent design stands out in a world that's increasingly marked by sleek, futuristic products. But ours is a society that has always obsessed over what the future might look like. In this next piece, produced by Andrew Parsons for Backstory with the American History Guys, we'll hear from a fan of the 1960s cartoon The Jetsons and find out why this satirical take on middle-class America became a watermark for the tech of the future.
My name is Matt Novak. I am editor of the Paleo Future blog on Gizmodo, and I am absolutely fascinated with The Jetsons. It's a cartoon that debuted in 1962, so over a half century ago, and yet we're still using it as a reference for futurism today. You can literally do a Google News search every single day and see people using the Jetsons in various forms.
Tired of waiting for a flying car? How to finally go all Jetsons with
them. It's all part of a trend that seems like something out of the Jetsons.
Jetsons, right? Remember that cartoon?
It kind of reminds me of the Jetsons.
It's like the Jetsons. It's like the Jetsons.
Sort of bring the smart home, that Jetsons future, down to an affordable level.
It's the Jetsons.
When people think of the Jetsons, they think of robots.
I should have all the answers for you in about 10 minutes.
This is our new maid, Rosie.
They think of flying cars.
Boy, the spaceway traffic gets worse every night.
They think of push buttons.
Hard day at the button, dear.
Oh, brutal. I had to push the button on and off 5 times.
A lot of us work at consoles where we're pushing buttons all day. In that respect, the Jetsons really is a Rorschach test. It is a way to understand the world as either a great predictor of the world that we live in today, or conversely, a great betrayal. So one of the fascinating aspects of the original 1962-63 version of the Jetsons is just how conservative it is. We live in a world of flying cars and jetpacks, and yet there is no social change. There are no people of color in the Jetsons. Jane, the mother, doesn't work outside of the home. Everything that you would imagine to change in this vision of the future is all technological. It's arguably all on the surface. There was this aspirational attitude about the entire series, that maintenance of the social status quo and maintenance of the nuclear family and husband, wife in their place, and each fulfilling very specific roles according to early 1960s TV culture.
I don't get it. When we first got married, you could punch out a breakfast like Mother used to make. Now you're all thumbs.
When people romanticize the Jetsons, they're romanticizing the past as much as they are the future. The middle class that the Jetsons represents is one that we were sold on in the 1950s, and you have to remember that the Jetsons is a parody show of 50s futurism. We were sold this idea of the three-hour workday. George Jetson works a three-hour workday, 3 days a week. There's a bit in the original Jetsons where George complains about,
those three-hour workdays are killing me.
Yeah, these three-hour workdays are killing me. You know, that's very clearly a joke, but this wasn't some radical idea that in the future automation would give us shorter work weeks and that we'd still maintain this amazing standard of living. These were government studies. You know, to have a short work week was taken as a given. In the 1950s, some sociologists were truly concerned that this would mean people would have no sense of purpose in their lives. There's even an episode where Jane Jetson gets incredibly depressed.
I feel so tired lately. Sometimes I think I'll go out of my mind.
You see this play out again and again in the Jetsons, where the family of the future would have all of this recreation time. And when you look back at the 1960s and how often the middle class actually did take more vacation time than today, that was just the natural progression of things. Of course we'd take more vacation time. Now, one of the things the Jetsons didn't tell us about was at every level of the American workforce today, people are on call because of these supposedly liberating devices like the smartphone. There's almost this mantra of, where is my jetpack? Where is my flying car? And you can draw a direct link to this TV show, The Jetsons, that people were watching as kids on constant repeat.
Where are our jetpacks? We were promised jetpacks. When do I get my jetpack?
Where's my flying car?
Let's do it.
I think it's warped sort of our understanding of futurism in general. Because it was so fixated on technological promises and totally devoid of any social change or anything that would certainly unfold in the next three decades.
That piece was produced by Andrew Parsons and the rest of the team at Backstory with the American History Guys. You can find a link to their show at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks for your listening time today. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org, the website I just literally mentioned. And if you missed any of the show, you can also catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at that website, wordofmouthradio.org. You could also search Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like it, tell a friend, pass it along. After all, the best suggestions tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. Join us for more Word of Mouth right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.